Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 201. It's called a break because this episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. You can find out more about the full Knitting Out Loud catalog by visiting knittingoutloud.com. Also, Knit Circus, the online magazine featuring three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can check out the latest issue at www.knitcircus.com. Also, holiday vacations and Craftlit take you on the road to Rhinebeck, starting in Boston, ending at Rhinebeck, a whole week of literary and fibery fun and goodness. Don't forget, reserve your seat now. It locks the price in. If the price of fuel skyrockets between now and October, your ticket price will not go up. So if there's even a small chance that you can go, please, please, please go and check out the website, craftlit.com. Click on the bright fall colorish thing in the upper right-hand corner, and that will take you directly to a page where you can find out more and find out how to contact Diane for more information. You can also ask questions on our Ravelry group. Craftlit has a Ravelry group, which you are more than welcome to join. Everyone is available there. And Diane is a moderator on that particular board, the trip board. So you can ask her questions directly there if you don't feel like picking up a phone, which, you know, I often don't. I feel like phones are so imposing. I like to text. It's that writing thing, right? I like to text. I like to email. I know Miss Manners prefers faxes. Oh, Miss Manners, where art thou? I used to love her column. Miss Manners, Judith Martin. I think I got all of her books. I just thought she was fascinating and hilarious. She wrote a really interesting, very little booklet. And it's hard to find. I still have my copy, but it's in a box right now. And it's something like Miss Manners solves the problem that evaded Thomas Jefferson, or something like that. And it's all about the problem of how do you have proper manners when you don't have a social hierarchy. Now, we can argue for years about whether or not the United States has a social hierarchy, but we don't have an official one. There isn't, you know, royalty and nobility and all that stuff. And so that caused trouble in making seating arrangements in the early years of this country, because how do you seat people at a table when the president's just the president? And all that means is that he's a citizen who we have elected to run things for us. It is a very interesting question, and Judith Martin, as always, weighs in marvelously. I'll see if I can find that for you. Ooh, and on the subject of good things to read, Bonnie, months ago in December, sent me an article, which I feared, and justifiably so, and I finally read a couple months ago, and I needed to pass it on to you, and I kept forgetting. So now I am telling you, I don't know if this is reachable online. I am going to give you the upshot. I will put all the information I can on the web. This is from the English Journal. I don't know how the English Journal does with its previous issues, if they have them online or if you have to go through ProQuest or Eric or something like that. But anyway, you're going to love the title. How Classics Create an Illiterate Society. That's right, folks. By listening to this show, you are making yourself illiterate. Stupid, in fact, because it's impossible that you could understand these books, just as it's impossible that teenagers could understand these books. Please, haven't we had this conversation enough times? Okay, so this is by a guy named Donald Gallo. And actually, I mean, in all fairness, this is from 2001. This is from January 2001, volume 90, issue 3, page 33. It's a 7-page long article. I could practically give you his home phone number so you could call him up and tell him that this really stinks. I don't know. I mean, we've all had this conversation about lousy teachers make a mishmash of difficult books. And we've all had lousy teachers. And, you know, I figure I'm supposed to be teaching in a classroom the books that the kids need a little bit of help to understand. Why would I need to give them young adult fiction? Now, one point that he makes, I do agree with, which is that I gave my students reading time in class, precious time in class. The first 10 minutes of every class was sustained silent reading. And they had young adult fiction. They could read potboilers. As long as it wasn't pornography, they could read pretty much anything they wanted. And they had to keep that in their journal. And, you know, every once in a while I talked to them about it, just to kind of make sure they were on track. That was very successful. But again, that's the stuff that they can read on their own. All I was doing was giving them a safe, quiet place to do that kind of reading. I didn't need to focus the whole classroom on it anyway. Oh my goodness, I will do whatever I can to get you as much of this information as I can. But yes, How Classics Create an Illiterate Society by Donald R. Gallo. Read it and weep. Oh, and the other little tidbit that I needed to tell you is I got a really smart email from Paula, from a listener, Paula, who's actually a couple books behind us right now. She wanted to get the iPhone application for her phone, but she wondered if it was possible via that application to search by book. And I realized that is the missing piece. And so what I'm building is a library page that will be a permanent fixture in the Android and the iPhone application. And that'll be on the show level, not on the episode level. And it will list by the range, you know, from episode 97 to episode 104. This is the book we're doing. So it'll have that information, but it'll also have live links that will take you to the web pages of those so that if for some reason you can't get the download to work, you can at least get spit out to the show notes. But mostly I am here to speed the plow because today we have two sections of Marian, the beginning of the second epoch. And the reader for the first one couldn't pronounce Catherick correctly. And as you'll hear, the name comes up often. And I couldn't do it to you. And the real problem is that the reader who reads the second one is Ruth Golding, who read Flatland, the one who's so good. And so it was, the dichotomy was appalling. And so because I was short of time, I went ahead and read it myself. And so you just have to put up with my lousy British accent that occasionally fades into Australian for reasons that are still a complete mystery to me. I have no idea why certain words just became Australian. So I apologize for that, but as bad as my reading is, I swear to you, it's better than what you would have heard otherwise. So apologies all around. You may wonder why I titled this episode It's Called a Break Because, and that's because this week is my boy's spring break, and there's no break. Life continues on as life has always continued on, and that means I spend a lot of time in the car, like many of you. And I'm a little nervous about the move to Virginia because I worry that I'm going to spend even more time in the car. That being said, I can catch up on podcasts, which is great, but since I'm also writing, that makes it a little tougher. Ooh, and I finished the novel on my spring break. This is how I spent my summer vacation. I spent my spring break finishing the novel for real. It is really done, and it's in the hands of a few readers right now, and the feedback so far is very good, so it'll go back to the agent, and then our fingers will be crossed, and who knows? You may actually someday be able to see this thing that I started talking about 2 years ago. So, you know, Virginia could be good, and I just hope there's time to keep writing. I still need to figure out how I am going to introduce this show from Virginia. If you have any ideas, you know, because I can't say my corner of the Sonoran Desert. I can't say, you know, my corner of Alexandria, Virginia. That just doesn't sound enticing, does it? We need to find something colonial-ish-y something. I'm not there yet, so I can't really see it yet. And on the subject of getting there, I need to make the trip back to Virginia if I'm going to be able to stop and see all the people who I want to stop and see, and that means Craftlit listeners all the way across the country. I'm going to have to make this a working trip. I'm going to have to stop and do book signings or teach classes or something if we are going to be able to afford the trip. So I've already talked to a number of people in various parts of the country, and I think I'm good once I pass Chicago, but getting to Chicago is going to be tricky. So I'm going to post a link to the road trip website so you can actually see where we plan on stopping. And you'll see that some of the stuff is for the boys, like, you know, seeing Old Faithful and seeing Devil's Tower and stuff like that. But obviously we can move a little bit further above or below the track that we're planning if there's something to do. So if you are in any states, Utah, going up, I'll be in Provo, and then cut through Provo Canyon, through Heber, and then up to Yellowstone. There's just lots of places where, you know, people don't usually go that I want to take the boys because it's beautiful. And I would very much like to work it out where I can meet more people and sign books and things like that. I am in the final edits of the book, and it is spectacular. And as I've said before, one of the things that we really, really like about this book is that it is very web connected. It is like, you know, book 2.0, in that once you have the book, you have links to all sorts of useful information. You are also going to have links to all of the fabulous color photographs of all of these pieces. We made some decisions, and I'm really excited. This actually comes out looking a little bit more like a Weldon's book, which I dig. And Jen's art that's in it, and the style and the fonts and all of that, it looks like a Madame Defarge book. So I'm very, very excited. I hope you are too. And, you know, what with it being kind of Web 2.0 book, we also are really hoping that when you take the patterns and do your magic to them, that you'll post pictures on the website so people will be able to see what you've done, or post links to your own blog where your pictures live, post them on Ravelry. You know, we want there to be a conversation about the patterns that we've created. And they are gorgeous. I'm in the middle of knitting a few of them myself right now, just because I couldn't stand it and I really needed to to do some of them. And oh my goodness, I am so excited. So it'll be coming soon, very soon, because we're in the final stages. So all of that said, I need to get on with the story because we have two parts. I think at this point I can pretty much say with some feeling of confidence that we like Marion Halcombe. She's just a neat character, and you are going to find in today's chapters, it's like sections of the book, the way it's written, you are going to find a much more pronounced personality. I mean, you're really going to hear very strongly her likes and dislikes, her beliefs about many things, even Queen Elizabeth. I mean, it just cracks me up. I'm fairly certain that you'll be surprised by her comments about Queen Elizabeth. And a number of things, actually. But there are some wonderful moments of foreshadowing, you know, foreboding, and things where when Marion says it, you start to go, I wonder if this matters. And the answer is yes, it does. A lot of groundwork is laid in this. And I encourage you to pay attention when she starts describing the layout of Blackwater, the house. Pay attention to the layout. It's kind of important. And the layout and the grounds, just like, you know, Pemberley, just like going back with Darcy, I think there is an assumption that can be made that the house is, in large respect, a metaphor for Sir Percival Glyde. And yeah, I think you could argue that. And Marion's reaction to the house and its grounds is, I think, rather important. Now, just to let you know what I'm doing, because this podcast is coming out late, and this next coming week is going to be ridiculously crazy. So what I am doing is, again, back-to-back podcasts recording. I'm going to record them today back-to-back, but I'm going to release them kind of on a timed schedule so that you don't go too long in between episodes. What that means is that 2001 and 2002 will share show notes, as I've done before, and that's it. That's all the news. So, without any further ado, I give you my pathetic reading of Marion Halcombe from the second epoch of The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. The Second Epoch, The Story Continued by Marion Halcombe. Blackwater Park, Hampshire. June 11th, 1850. 6 months to look back on. 6 long, lonely months since Laura and I last saw each other. How many days have I still to wait? Only one. Tomorrow, the 12th. The travelers return to England. I can hardly realize my own happiness. I can hardly believe that the next 4 and 20 hours will complete the last day of separation between Laura and me. She and her husband have been in Italy all the winter, and afterwards in the Tyrol. They come back, accompanied by Count Fosco and his wife, who propose to settle somewhere in the neighborhood of London, and who have engaged to stay at Blackwater Park for the summer months before deciding on a place of residence. So long as Laura returns, no matter who returns with her, Sir Percival may fill the house from floor to ceiling if he likes, on condition that his wife and I inhabit it together. Meanwhile, here I am, established at Blackwater Park, the ancient and interesting seat, as the county history obligingly informs me, of Sir Percival Glyde, Bart, and the future abiding place, as I may now venture to add on my account, of plain Marion Halcombe, spinster, now settled in a snug little sitting room with a cup of tea by her side, and all her earthly possessions ranged round her in 3 boxes and a bag. I left Limeridge yesterday, having received Laura's delightful letter from Paris the day before. I had been previously uncertain whether I was to meet them in London or in Hampshire, but this last letter informed me that Sir Percival proposed to land at Southampton, and to travel straight on to his country house. He has spent so much money abroad that he has none left to defray the expense of living in London for the remainder of the season, and he is economically resolved to pass the summer and autumn quietly at Blackwater. Laura has had more than enough of excitement and change of scene, and is pleased at the prospect of country tranquillity and retirement which her husband's prudence provides for her. As for me, I am ready to be happy anywhere in her society. We are all, therefore, well contented in our various ways, to begin with. Last night I slept in London, and was delayed there so long today by various calls and commissions that I did not reach Blackwater this evening till after dusk. Judging by my vague impressions of the place thus far, it is the exact opposite of Limeridge. The house is situated on a dead flat, and seems to be shut in, almost suffocated, to my north country notions, by trees. I have seen nobody but the manservant who opened the door to me, and the housekeeper, a very civil person, who showed me the way to my own room and got me my tea. I have a nice little boudoir and bedroom at the end of a long passage on the first floor. The servants in some of the spare rooms are on the second floor, and all the living rooms are on the ground floor. I have not seen one of them yet, and I know nothing about the house except that one wing of it is said to be 500 years old. That it had a moat round it once, and that it gets its name of Blackwater from a lake in the park. 11 o'clock has just struck, in a ghostly and solemn manner, from a turret over the center of the house, which I saw when I came in. A large dog has been woke, apparently, by the sound of the bell, and is howling and yawning drearily somewhere around a corner. I hear echoing footsteps in the passages below, and the iron thumping of bolts and bars at the house door. The servants are evidently going to bed. Shall I follow their example? No, I am not half sleepy enough. Sleepy, did I say? I feel as I should never close my eyes again. The bare anticipation of seeing that dear face and hearing that well-known voice tomorrow keeps me in a perpetual fever of excitement. If I only had the privileges of a man, I would order out Sir Percival's best horse instantly, and tear away on a night gallop eastward to meet the rising sun, a long, hard, heavy, ceaseless gallop of hours and hours like the famous highwayman's ride to York. Being, however, nothing more but a woman condemned to patience, propriety, and petticoats for life, I must respect the housekeeper's opinions and try to compose myself in some feeble and feminine way. Reading is out of the question. I can't fix my attention on books. Let me try if I can write myself into sleepiness and fatigue. My journal has been very much neglected of late. What can I recall, standing as I now do on the threshold of a new life, of persons and events, of chances and changes during the past 6 months, the long, weary, empty interval since Laura's wedding day? Walter Hartwright is uppermost in my memory, and he passes first in the shadowy procession of my absent friends. I received a few lines from him, after the landing of the expedition in Honduras, written more cheerfully and hopefully than he has written yet. A month or 6 weeks later, I saw an extract from an American newspaper describing the departure of the adventurers on their inland journey. They were last seen entering a wild primeval forest, each man with a rifle on his shoulder and his baggage at his back. Since that time, civilization has lost all trace of them. Not a line more have I received from Walter. Not a fragment of news from the expedition has appeared in any of the public journals. The same dense, disheartening obscurity hangs over the fate and fortunes of Anne Catherick and her companion, Mrs. Clements. Nothing whatever has been heard of either of them. Whether they are in the country or out of it, whether they are living or dead, no one knows. Even Sir Percival's solicitor has lost all hope and has ordered the useless search after the fugitives to be finally given up. Our good old friend Mr. Gilmore has met with a sad check in his active professional career. Early in the spring we were alarmed by hearing that he had been found insensible at his desk, and that the seizure was pronounced to be an apoplectic fit. He had been long complaining of fullness and oppression in the head, and his doctor had warned him of the consequences that would follow his persistency in continuing to work early and late as if he were still a young man. The result now is that he has been positively ordered to keep out of his office for a year to come at least, and to seek repose of body and relief of mind by altogether changing his usual mode of life. The business is left accordingly to be carried on by his partner, and he is himself at this moment away in Germany, visiting some relations who are settled there in mercantile pursuits. Thus, another true friend and trustworthy adviser is lost to us. Lost, I earnestly hope and trust, for a time only. Poor Mrs. Vesey traveled with me as far as London. It was impossible to abandon her to solitude at Limeridge after Laura and I had both left the house, and we have arranged that she is to live with an unmarried younger sister of hers who keeps a school at Clapham. She is to come here this autumn to visit her pupil, I might almost say her adopted child. I saw the good old lady safe to her destination and left her in the care of her relative, quietly happy at the prospect of seeing Laura again in a few months' time. As for Mr. Fairley, I believe I am guilty of no injustice if I describe him as being unutterably relieved by having the house clear of us women. The idea of his missing his niece is simply preposterous. He used to let months pass in the old times without attempting to see her, and in my case, and Mrs. Vesey's, I take leave to consider his telling us both that he was half-heartbroken at our departure to be equivalent to a confession that he was secretly rejoiced to get rid of us. His last caprice has led him to keep two photographers incessantly employed in producing sun pictures of all the treasures and curiosities in his possession. One complete copy of the collection of the photographs is to be presented to the Mechanics Institution of Carlisle, mounted on the finest cardboard with the ostentatious red-letter inscription underneath, Madonna and Child by Raphael, in the possession of Frederick Fairley, Esquire, copper coin of the period of Tiglath-Pileser, in the possession of Frederick Fairley, Esquire, unique Rembrandt etching, known all over Europe as the Smudge, from a printer's blot in the corner which exists in no other copy, valued at 300 guineas, in the possession of Frederick Fairley, Esquire. Dozens of photographs of this sort, and all inscribed in this manner, were completed before I left Cumberland, and hundreds more remain to be done. With this new interest to occupy him, Mr. Fairley will be a happy man for months and months to come, and the two unfortunate photographers will share the social martyrdom which he has hitherto inflicted on his valet alone. So much for the persons and events which hold the foremost place in my memory. What next of the one person who holds the foremost place in my heart? Laura has been present in my thoughts all the while I have been writing these lines. What can I recall of her during the past 6 months before I close my journal for the night? I have only her letters to guide me, and on the most important of all the questions which our correspondents can discuss, every one of those letters leaves me in the dark. Does he treat her kindly? Is she happier now than she was when I parted with her on her wedding day? All my letters have contained these two inquiries, put more or less directly, now in one form, now in another, and all, on that point only, have remained without reply, or have been answered, as if my questions merely related to the state of her health. She informs me, over and over again, that she is perfectly well, that traveling agrees with her, that she is getting through the winter for the first time in her life without catching cold. But not a word can I find anywhere which tells me plainly that she is reconciled to her marriage, and that she can now look back to the 22nd of December without any bitter feelings of repentance and regret. The name of her husband is only mentioned in her letters, as she might mention the name of a friend who was traveling with them, and who had undertaken to make all the arrangements for the journey. Sir Percival have settled that we will leave on such and such a day. Sir Percival has decided that we will travel by such a road. Sometimes she writes Percival only, but very seldom. In 9 cases out of 10, she gives him his title. I cannot find that his habits and opinions have changed and colored hers in any single particular. The usual moral transformation which is insensibly wrought in a young, fresh, sensitive woman by her marriage seems never to have taken place in Laura. She writes of her own thoughts and impressions amid all the wonders she has seen, exactly as she might have written to someone else if I had been traveling with her instead of her husband. I see no betrayal anywhere of sympathy of any kind existing between them. Even when she wanders from the subject of her travels and occupies herself with the prospects that await her in England, her speculations are busied with her future as my sister, and persistently neglect to notice her future as Sir Percival's wife. In all this, there is no undertone of complaint to warn me that she is absolutely unhappy in her married life. The impression I have derived from our correspondence does not, thank God, lead me to any such distressing conclusion as that. I only see a sad torpor, an unchangeable indifference, when I turn my mind from her in the old character of a sister, and look at her through the medium of her letters, in the new character of a wife. In other words, it is always Laura Fairley who has been writing to me for the last 6 months, and never Lady Glyde. The strange silence which she maintains on the subject of her husband's character and conduct, she preserves with almost equal resolution in the few references which her later letters contain to the name of her husband's bosom friend, Count Fosco. For some unexplained reason, the Count and his wife appear to have changed their plans abruptly at the end of last autumn, and to have gone to Vienna instead of going to Rome, at which later place Sir Percival had expected to find them when he left England. They only quitted Vienna in the spring, and travelled as far as the Tyrol to meet the bride and groom on their homeward journey. Laura writes readily enough about the meeting with Madame Fosco, and assures me that she has found her aunt so much changed for the better, so much quieter, and so much more sensible as a wife than she was as a single woman, that I shall hardly know her again when I see her here. But on the subject of Count Fosco, who interests me infinitely more than his wife, Laura is provokingly circumspect and silent. She only says that he puzzles her, and that she will not tell him what her impression of him is until I have seen him and formed my own opinion first. This, to my mind, looks ill for the Count. Laura has preserved far more perfectly than most people do in later life the child's subtle faculty of knowing a friend by instinct, And if I am right in assuming that her first impression of Count Fosco has not been favorable, I, for one, am in some danger of doubting and distrusting that illustrious foreigner before I have so much as set my eyes on him. But patience, patience. This uncertainty and many uncertainties more cannot last much longer. Tomorrow will see all my doubts in a fair way of being cleared up sooner or later. 12 o'clock has struck, and I have just come back to close these pages after looking out at my open window. It is a still, sultry, moonless night. The stars are dull and few. The trees that shut out the view on all sides look dimly black and solid in the distance, like a great wall of rock. I hear the croaking of frogs faint and far off, and the echoes of the great clock hum in the airless calm long after the strokes have ceased. I wonder how Blackwater Park will look in the daytime. I don't altogether like it by night. 12th. A day of investigations and discoveries, a more interesting day for many reasons than I had ventured to anticipate. I began my sightseeing, of course, with the house. The main body of the building is of the time of that highly overrated woman, Queen Elizabeth. On the ground floor, there are two hugely long galleries with low ceilings lying parallel with each other and rendered additionally dark and dismal by hideous family portraits, every one of which I should like to burn. The rooms on the floor above the two galleries are kept in tolerable repair, but are very seldom used. The civil housekeeper, who acted as my guide, offered to show me over them, but considerably added that she feared I should find them rather out of order. My respect for the integrity of my own petticoats and stockings infinitely exceeds my respect for all the Elizabethan bedrooms in the kingdom, so I positively declined exploring the upper regions of dust and dirt at the risk of soiling my nice clean clothes. The housekeeper said, "I'm quite of your opinion, miss," and appeared to think me the most sensible woman she had met with for a long time past. So much, then, for the main building. Two wings are added at either end of it. The half-ruined wing on the left, as you approach the house, was once a place of residence standing by itself, and was built in the 14th century. One of Sir Percival's maternal ancestors, I don't remember and I don't care which, tacked on the main building at right angles to it in the aforesaid Queen Elizabeth's time. The housekeeper told me that the architecture of the old wing, both outside and inside, was considered remarkably fine by good judges. On further investigation, I discovered that good judges could only exercise their abilities on Sir Percival's piece of antiquity by previously dismissing from their minds all fear of damp, darkness, and rats. Under these circumstances, I unhesitatingly acknowledged myself to be no judge at all, and suggested that we should treat the old wing precisely as we had previously treated the Elizabethan bedrooms. Once more, the housekeeper said, "I'm quite of your opinion, miss." And once more she looked at me with undisguised admiration of my extraordinary common sense. We went next to the wing on the right, which was built, by way of completing the wonderful architectural jumble at Blackwater Park, in the time of George II. This is the habitable part of the house, which has been repaired and redecorated inside, on Laura's account. My two rooms, and all the good bedrooms besides, are on the first floor, and the basement contains a drawing room, a dining room, a morning room, a library, and a pretty little boudoir for Laura, all very nicely ornamented in the bright modern way, and all very elegantly furnished with the delightful modern luxuries. None of the rooms are anything like so large and airy as our rooms at Limeridge, but they all look pleasant to live in. I was terribly afraid, from what I had heard of Blackwater Park, of fatiguing antique chairs and dismal stained glass and musty frouzy hangings and all the barbarous lumber which people born without sense of comfort accumulate about them in defiance of all the consideration due to the convenience of their friends. It is an inexpressible relief to find that the 19th century has invaded this strange future home of mine and has swept the dirty, good old times out of the way of our daily life. I dawdled away the morning, part of the time in the rooms downstairs and part out of doors in the great square which is formed by the three sides of the house and by the lofty iron railings and gates which protect it in front. A large circular fish pond with stone sides and an allegorical leaden monster in the middle occupies the center of the square. The pond itself is full of gold and silver fish and is encircled by a broad belt of the softest turf I have ever walked on. I loitered here on the shady side pleasantly enough till luncheon time, and after that took my broad straw hat and wandered out alone in the warm, lovely sunlight to explore the grounds. Daylight confirmed the impression which I had felt the night before of there being too many trees at Blackwater. The house is stifled by them. They are, for the most part, young and planted far too thickly. I suspect there must have been a ruinous cutting down of timber all over the estate before Sir Percival's time, and an angry anxiety on the part of the next possessor to fill up all the gaps as thickly and as rapidly as possible. After looking about me in front of the house, I observed a flower garden on my left hand and walked towards it to see what I could discover in that direction. On a nearer view, the garden proved to be small, poor, and ill-kept. I left it behind me, opened a little gate in a ring fence, and found myself in a plantation of fir trees. A pretty winding path, artificially made, led me on among the trees, and my north country experience soon informed me that I was approaching sandy, heathy ground. After a walk of more than a mile, I should think, among the firs, the path took a sharp turn. The trees abruptly ceased to appear on either side of me, and I found myself standing suddenly on the margin of a vast open space, and looking down at the Blackwater Lake, from which the house takes its name. The ground, shelving away below me, was all sand, with a few little healthy hillocks to break the monotony of it in certain places. The lake itself had evidently once flowed to the spot on which I stood, and had been gradually wasted and dried up to less than a third of its former size. I saw its still stagnant waters, a quarter of a mile away from me in the hollow, separated into pools and ponds by twining reeds and rushes and little knolls of earth. On the farther bank from me, the trees rose thickly again and shut out the view, and cast their black shadows on the sluggish, shallow water. As I walked down to the lake, I saw that the ground on its farther side was damp and marshy, overgrown with rank grass and dismal willows. The water, which was clear enough on the open sandy side, where the sun shone, looked black and poisonous opposite to me, where it lay deeper under the shade of the spongy banks and the rank, overhanging thickets and tangled trees. The frogs were croaking, and the rats were slipping in and out of the shadowy water, like live shadows themselves, as I got nearer to the marshy side of the lake. I saw here, lying half in and half out of the water, the rotten wreck of an old overturned boat, with a sickly spot of sunlight glimmering through the gap in the trees on its dry surface, and a snake basking in the midst of the spot, fantastically coiled and treacherously still. Far and near, the view suggested the same dreary impressions of solitude and decay, and the glorious brightness of the summer sky overhead seemed only to deepen and harden the gloom and barrenness of the wilderness on which it shone. I turned and retraced my steps to the high, heathy ground, directing them a little aside from my former path, towards a shabby old wooden shed, which stood on the outer skirt of the fir plantation, and which had hitherto been too unimportant to share my notice with the wide, wild prospect of the lake. On approaching the shed, I found that it had once been a boathouse, and that an attempt had apparently been made to convert it afterwards into sort of a rude arbor by placing inside it a firwood seat, a few stools, and a table. I entered the place and sat down for a little while to rest and get my breath again. I had not been in the boathouse more than a minute when it struck me that the sound of my own quick breathing was very strangely echoed by something beneath me. I listened intently for a moment, and heard a low, thick, sobbing breath that seemed to come from the ground under the seat which I was occupying. My nerves are not easily shaken by trifles, but on this occasion I started to my feet in a fright, called out, received no answer, summoned back my recreant courage, and looked under the seat. There, crouched up in the farthest corner, lay the forlorn cause of my terror in the shape of a poor little dog, a black and white spaniel. The creature moaned feebly when I looked at it and called to it, but it never stirred. I moved away the seat and looked closer. The poor little dog's eyes were glazing fast, and there were spots of blood on its glossy white side. The misery of a weak, helpless, dumb creature is surely one of the saddest of all the mournful sights which this world can show. I lifted the poor dog in my arms as gently as I could, and contrived a sort of makeshift hammock for him to lie in by gathering up the front of my dress all round him. In this way, I took the creature as painlessly as possible, and as fast as possible, back to the house. Finding no one in the hall, I went up at once to my own sitting room, made a bed for the dog with one of my old shawls, and rang the bell. The largest and the fattest of all possible housemaids answered it, in a state of cheerful stupidity which would have provoked the patience of a saint. The girl's fat, shapeless face actually stretched into a broad grin at the sight of the wounded creature on the floor. "What do you see there to laugh at?" I asked as angrily as if she had been a servant of my own. "Do you know whose dog this is?" "No, miss, that I certainly don't." She stooped and looked down at the spaniel's injured side, brightened suddenly with the irradiation of a new idea, and pointing to the wound with a chuckle and satisfaction, said, "That's Baxter's doings, that is." I was so exasperated that I could have boxed her ears. "Baxter?" I said, "who is the brute you call Baxter?" The girl grinned again, more cheerfully than ever. "Bless you, miss. Baxter's the keeper, and when he finds strange dogs hunting about, he takes them and shoots them. It's keeper's duty, miss. I think that dog will die. Here's where he's been shot, ain't it? That's Baxter's doings, that is. Baxter's doing, miss, and Baxter's duty." I was almost wicked enough to wish that Baxter had shot the housemaid instead of the dog, seeing that it was quite useless to expect this densely impenetrable personage to give me any help in relieving the suffering of the creature at our feet. I told her to request the housekeeper's attendance with my compliments. She went out exactly as she had come in, grinning from ear to ear. As the door closed on her, she said to herself softly, "It's Baxter's doings and Baxter's duty. That's what it is." The housekeeper, a person of some education and intelligence, thoughtfully brought upstairs with her some milk and some warm water. The instant she saw the dog on the floor, she started and changed color. "Why, Lord bless me!" cried the housekeeper. "That must be Mrs. Catherick's dog!" "Whose?" I asked in the utmost astonishment. "Mrs. Catherick's. You seem to know Mrs. Catherick, Miss Halcombe?" "Not personally, but I have heard of her. Does she live here? Has she had any news of her daughter?" "No, Miss Halcombe. She came here to ask for news." "When?" "Only yesterday. She said someone had reported that a stranger answering to the description of her daughter had been seen in our neighborhood. No such report has reached us here, and no such report was known in the village when I sent to make inquiries there on Mrs. Catherick's account. She certainly brought this poor little dog with her when she came, and I saw it trot out after her when she went away. I suppose the creature strayed into the plantations and got shot. Where did you find it, Miss Halcombe?"
"In the old shed that looks out on the lake."
"Ah, yes, that is the plantation side, and the poor thing dragged itself, I suppose, to the nearest shelter as dogs will do to die. If you can moisten its lips with the milk, Miss Halcombe, I will wash the clotted hair from around the wound. I'm very much afraid it's too late to do any good, however, but we can try."
Mrs. Catherick! The name still rang in my ears, as if the housekeeper had only that moment surprised me by uttering it. While we were attending to the dog, the words of Walter Hartwright's caution to me returned to my memory. "If ever Anne Catherick crosses your path, make better use of the opportunity, Miss Halcombe, than I made of it." The finding of the wounded spaniel had led me already to the discovery of Mrs. Catherick's visit to Blackwater Park, and that event might lead in its turn to something more. I determined to make the most of the chance which was now offered to me, and to gain as much information as I could.
"Did you say that Mrs. Catherick lived anywhere in this neighborhood?" I asked.
Oh, dear no, said the housekeeper. She lives at Wilmingham, quite off the other end of the county, 25 miles off at least. I suppose you have known Mrs. Catherick for some years. On the contrary, Miss Halcombe, I never saw her before she came here yesterday. I have heard of her, of course, because I had heard of Sir Percival's kindness in putting her daughter under medical care. Mrs. Catherick is rather a strange person in her manners, but extremely respectable-looking. She seemed sorely put out when she found that there was no foundation, none at least that any of us could discover, for the report of her daughter having been seen in this neighbourhood. I am rather interested about Mrs. Catherick, I went on, continuing the conversation as long as possible. I wish I had arrived here soon enough to see her yesterday. Did she stay for any length of time? Yes, said the housekeeper. She stayed for some time, and I think she would have remained longer if I had not been called away to speak to a strange gentleman, a gentleman who came back to ask when Sir Percival was expected back. Mrs. Catherick got up and left at once, when she heard the maid tell me that what the visitor's errand was. She said to me, at parting, that there was no need to tell Sir Percival of her coming here. I thought that a rather odd remark to make, especially to a person in my responsible situation. I thought it an odd remark, too. Sir Percival had certainly led me to believe, at Limeridge, that the most perfect coincidence existed between himself and Mrs. Catherick. If that was the case, why should she be anxious to have her visit at Blackwater Park kept a secret from him? Probably, I said, seeing that the housekeeper expected me to give my opinion on Mrs. Catherick's parting words, probably she thought the announcement of her visit might vex Sir Percival to no purpose, by reminding him that her lost daughter was not found yet. Did she talk much on the subject? Very little, replied the housekeeper. She talked principally of Sir Percival, and asked a great many questions about where he had been travelling, and what sort of lady was his new wife. She seemed to be more soured and put out than distressed, by failing to find any traces of her daughter in these parts. I give her up, were the last words she said that I can remember. I give her up, ma'am, for lost. And from that she passed at once to her questions about Lady Glyde, wanting to know if she was handsome, amiable, comely, healthy, young. Ah, dear, I thought how it would end. Look, Miss Halcombe, the poor thing is out of its misery at last. The dog was dead. It had given a faint, sobbing cry. It had suffered an instant's convulsion of the limbs, just as those last words, comely and healthy and young, dropped from the housekeeper's lips. The change had happened with startling suddenness. In one moment the creature lay lifeless under our hands. 8 o'clock. I have just returned from dining downstairs in solitary state. The sunset is burning redly on the wilderness of trees that I see from my window, and I am poring over my journal again to calm my impatience for the return of the travellers. They ought to have arrived, by my calculations, before this. How still and lonely the house is in the drowsy evening quiet. Oh me, how many minutes more before I hear the carriage wheels and run downstairs to find myself in Laura's arms. The poor little dog! I wish my first day at Blackwater Park had not been associated with death, though it is only the death of a stray animal. Wilmingham. I see, on looking back through these private pages of mine, that Wilmingham is the name of the place where Mrs. Catherick lives. Her note is still in my possession, the note in answer to that letter about her unhappy daughter, which Sir Percival obliged me to write. One of these days, when I can find a safe opportunity, I will take that note with me by way of introduction, and try what I can make of Mrs. Catherick at a personal interview. I don't understand her wishing to conceal her visit to this place from Sir Percival's knowledge, and I don't feel half so sure as the housekeeper seems to, that her daughter Anne is not in the neighbourhood after all. What would Walter Hartwright have said in this emergency? Poor dear Hartwright! I am beginning to feel the want of his honest advice, and his willing help already. Surely I heard something. Was it a bustle of footsteps below stairs? Yes, I hear the horses' feet. I hear the rolling wheels.
The Second Epoch, 2. June 15th. The confusion of their arrival has had time to subside. 2 days have elapsed since the return of the travellers, and that interval has sufficed to put the new machinery of our lives at Blackwater Park in fair working order. I may now return to my journal, with some little chance of being able to continue the entries in it as collectedly as usual. I think I must begin by putting down an odd remark which has suggested itself to me since Laura came back. When two members of a family or two intimate friends are separated, and one goes abroad and one remains at home, the return of the relative or friend who has been travelling always seems to place the relative or friend who has been staying at home at a painful disadvantage when the two first meet. The sudden encounter of the new thoughts and new habits eagerly gained in the one case, with the old thoughts and old habits passively preserved in the other, seems at first to part the sympathies of the most loving relatives and the fondest friends, and to set a sudden strangeness, unexpected by both and uncontrollable by both, between them on either side. After the first happiness of my meeting with Laura was over, after we had sat down together hand in hand to recover breath enough and calmness enough to talk, I felt this strangeness instantly, and I could see that she felt it too. It has partially worn away now that we have fallen back into most of our old habits, and it will probably disappear before long. But it has certainly had an influence over the first impressions that I have formed of her, now that we are living together again, for which reason only I have thought fit to mention it here. She has found me unaltered, but I have found her changed. Changed in person, and in one respect changed in character. I cannot absolutely say that she is less beautiful than she used to be. I can only say that she is less beautiful to me. Others, who do not look at her with my eyes and my recollections, would probably think her improved. There is more colour and more decision and roundness of outline in her face than there used to be, and her figure seems more firmly set and more sure and easy in all its movements than it was in her maiden days. But I miss something when I look at her, something that once belonged to the happy, innocent life of Laura Fairley, and that I cannot find in Lady Glyde. There was in the old times a freshness, a softness, an ever-varying and yet ever-remaining tenderness of beauty in her face, the charm of which it is not possible to express in words, or, as poor Hartwright used often to say, in painting either. This is gone. I thought I saw the faint reflection of it for a moment when she turned pale under the agitation of our sudden meeting on the evening of her return. But it has never reappeared since. None of her letters had prepared me for a personal change in her. On the contrary, they had led me to expect that her marriage had left her, in appearance at least, quite unaltered. Perhaps I read her letters wrongly in the past, and am now reading her face wrongly in the present. No matter. Whether her beauty has gained, or whether it has lost in the last 6 months, the separation either way has made her own dear self more precious to me than ever. And that is one good result of her marriage, at any rate. The second change, the change that I have observed in her character, has not surprised me, because I was prepared for it in this case by the tone of her letters. Now that she is at home again, I find her just as unwilling to enter into any details on the subject of her married life as I had previously found her all through the time of our separation, when we could only communicate with each other by writing. At the first approach I made to the forbidden topic, she put her hands on my lips, with a look and gesture which, touchingly, almost painfully, recalled to my memories the days of her girlhood, and the happy bygone time when there were no secrets between us. "Whenever you and I are together, Marian," she said, "we shall both be happier and easier with one another if we accept my married life for what it is, and say and think as little about it as possible. I would tell you everything, darling, about myself," she went on, nervously buckling and unbuckling the ribbon round my waist, if my confidences could only end there. But they could not. They would lead me into confidences about my husband, too. And now I am married, I think I had better avoid them for his sake, and for your sake, and for mine. I don't say that they would distress you, or distress me. I wouldn't have you think that for the world, but I want to be so happy now I have got you back again, and I want you to be so happy too. She broke off abruptly and looked round the room, my own sitting-room, in which we were talking. "Ah!" she cried, clapping her hands with a bright smile of recognition. "Another old friend found already. Your bookcase, Marion. Your dear little shabby old satinwood bookcase. How glad I am you brought it with you from Limeridge. And the horrid heavy man's umbrella that you would always walk out with when it rained. And first and foremost of all, your own dear, dark, clever gypsy face looking at me just as usual. It is so like home again to be here. How can we make it more like home still? I will put my father's portrait in your room instead of in mine, and I will keep all my little treasures from Limeridge here, and we will pass hours and hours every day with these four friendly walls around us. Oh, Marion," she said, suddenly seating herself on a footstool at my knees and looking up earnestly in my face, "promise you will never marry and leave me. It is selfish to say so, but you are so much better off as a single woman, unless you are very fond of your husband. But you won't be very fond of anybody but me, will you?" She stopped again, crossed my hands on my lap, and laid her face on them. "Have you been writing many letters, and receiving many letters lately?" she asked, in low, suddenly altered tones. I understood what the question meant, but I thought it my duty not to encourage her by meeting her halfway. "Have you heard from him?" she went on, coaxing me to forgive the more direct appeal on which she now ventured, by kissing my hands, upon which her face still rested. "Is he well and happy, and getting on in his profession? Has he recovered himself, and forgotten me?" She should not have asked those questions. She should have remembered her own resolution on the morning when Sir Percival held her to her marriage engagement, and when she resigned the Book of Hartwright's drawings into my hands for ever. But, ah me, where is the faultless human creature who can persevere in a good resolution without sometimes failing and falling back? Where is the woman who has ever really torn from her heart the image that has been once fixed in it by a true love? Books tell us that such unearthly creatures have existed, but what does our own experience say in answer to books? I made no attempt to remonstrate with her, perhaps because I sincerely appreciated the fearless candour which let me see what other women in her position might have had reasons for concealing, even from their dearest friends, perhaps because I felt in my own heart and conscience that in her place I should have asked the same questions and had the same thoughts. All I could honestly do was to reply that I had not written to him or heard from him lately, and then to turn the conversation to less dangerous topics. There has been much to sadden me in our interview, my first confidential interview with her since her return. The change which her marriage has produced in our relations towards each other by placing a forbidden subject between us for the first time in our lives. The melancholy conviction of the dearth of all warmth of feeling, of all close sympathy between her husband and herself, which her own unwilling words now force on my mind. The distressing discovery that the influence of that ill-fated attachment still remains, no matter how innocently, how harmlessly, rooted as deeply as ever in her heart. All these are disclosures to sadden any woman who loves her as dearly, and feels for her as acutely as I do. There is only one consolation to set against them, a consolation that ought to comfort me, and that does comfort me. All the graces and gentleness of her character, all the frank affection of her nature, all the sweet, simple, womanly charms which used to make her the darling and delight of everyone who approached her, have come back to me with herself. Of my other impressions I am sometimes a little inclined to doubt. Of this last, best, happiest of all impressions, I grow more and more certain every hour in the day. Let me turn now from her to her travelling companions. Her husband must engage my attention first. What have I observed in Sir Percival since his return to improve my opinion of him? I can hardly say. Small vexations and annoyances seem to have beset him since he came back, and no man under those circumstances is ever presented at his best. He looks, as I think, thinner than he was when he left England. His wearisome cough and his comfortless restlessness have certainly increased. His manner, at least his manner towards me, is much more abrupt than it used to be. He greeted me on the evening of his return with little or nothing of the ceremony and civility of former times, no polite speeches of welcome, no appearance of extraordinary gratification at seeing me, nothing but a short shake of the hand and a sharp, "How do you do, Miss Halcombe? Glad to see you again." He seemed to accept me as one of the necessary fixtures of Blackwater Park, to be satisfied at finding me established in my proper place, and then to pass me over altogether. Most men show something of their disposition in their own houses, which they have concealed elsewhere, and Sir Percival has already displayed a mania for order and regularity, which is quite a new revelation of him, so far as my previous knowledge of his character is concerned. If I take a book from the library and leave it on the table, he follows me and puts it back again. If I rise from a chair and let it remain where I have been sitting, he carefully restores it to its proper place against the wall. He picks up stray flower blossoms from the carpet and mutters to himself as discontentedly as if there were hot cinders burning holes in it, and he storms at the servants if there is a crease in the tablecloth or a knife missing from its place at the dinner table, as fiercely as if they had personally insulted him. I have already referred to the small annoyances which appear to have troubled him since his return. Much of the alteration for the worse which I have noticed in him may be due to these. I try to persuade myself that it is so, because I am anxious not to be disheartened already about the future. It is certainly trying to any man's temper to be met by a vexation the moment he sets foot in his own house again after a long absence, and this annoying circumstance did really happen to Sir Percival in my presence. On the evening of their arrival, the housekeeper followed me into the hall to receive her master and mistress and their guests. The instant he saw her, Sir Percival asked if anyone had called lately. The housekeeper mentioned to him in reply what she had previously mentioned to me, the visit of the strange gentleman to make inquiries about the time of her master's return. He asked immediately for the gentleman's name. No name had been left. The gentleman's business? No business had been mentioned. What was the gentleman like? The housekeeper tried to describe him, but failed to distinguish the nameless visitor by any personal peculiarity which her master could recognise. Sir Percival frowned, stamped angrily on the floor, and walked on into the house, taking no notice of anybody. Why he should have been so discomposed by a trifle I cannot say, but he was seriously discomposed beyond all doubt. Upon the whole, it will be best, perhaps, if I abstain from forming a decisive opinion of his manners, language, and conduct in his own house until time has enabled him to shake off the anxieties, whatever they may be, which now evidently troubled his mind in secret. I will turn over to a new page, and my pen shall let Laura's husband alone for the present. The two guests, the Count and Countess Fosco, come next in my catalogue. I will dispose of the Countess first, so as to have done with the woman as soon as possible. Laura was certainly not chargeable with any exaggeration in writing me word that I should hardly recognise her aunt again when we met. Never before have I beheld such a change produced in a woman by her marriage as has been produced in Madame Fosco. As Eleanor Fairley, aged 37, she was always talking pretentious nonsense, and always worrying the unfortunate men with every small exaction which a vain and foolish woman can impose on long-suffering male humanity. As Madame Fosco, aged 43, she sits for hours together without saying a word, frozen up in the strangest manner in herself. The hideously ridiculous love-locks which used to hang on either side of her face are now replaced by stiff little rows of very short curls, of the sort one sees in old-fashioned wigs. A plain matronly cap covers her head, and makes her look, for the first time in her life since I remember her, like a decent woman. Nobody, putting her husband out of the question, of course, now sees in her what everybody once saw, I mean the structure of the female skeleton in the upper regions of the collarbones and the shoulder blades. Clad in quiet black or grey gowns made high round the throat, dresses that she would have laughed at or screamed at, as the whim of the moment inclined her, in her maiden days, she sits speechless in corners, her dry white hands, so dry that the pores of her skin look chalky, incessantly engaged either in monotonous embroidery work or in rolling up endless cigarettes for the Count's own particular smoking. On the few occasions when her cold blue eyes are off her work, they are generally turned on her husband with the look of mute submissive inquiry which we are all familiar with in the eyes of a faithful dog. The only approach to an inward thaw which I have yet detected under her outer covering of icy constraint has betrayed itself once or twice in the form of a suppressed tigerish jealousy of any woman in the house, the maids included, to whom the Count speaks, or on whom he looks with anything approaching to special interest or attention. Except in this one particular, she is always, morning, noon, and night, indoors and out, fair weather or foul, as cold as a statue, and as impenetrable as the stone out of which it is cut. For the common purposes of society, the extraordinary change thus produced in her is, beyond all doubt, a change for the better, seeing that it has transformed her into a civil, silent, unobtrusive woman who is never in the way. How far she is really reformed or deteriorated in her secret self is another question. I have once or twice seen sudden changes of expression on her pinched lips, and heard sudden inflections of tone in her calm voice, which have led me to suspect that her present state of suppression may have sealed up something dangerous in her nature, which used to evaporate harmlessly in the freedom of her former life. It is quite possible that I may be altogether wrong in this idea. My own impression, however, is that I am right. Time will show. And the magician who has wrought this wonderful transformation, the foreign husband who has tamed this once wayward Englishwoman till her own relations hardly know her again, the Count himself? What of the Count? This in two words, he looks like a man who could tame anything. If he had married a tigress instead of a woman, he would have tamed the tigress. If he had married me, I should have made his cigarettes as his wife does. I should have held my tongue when he looked at me as she holds hers. I am almost afraid to confess it even to these secret pages. The man has interested me, has attracted me, has forced me to like him. In 2 short days he has made his way straight into my favourable estimation, and how he has worked the miracle is more than I can tell. It absolutely startles me, now he is in my mind, to find how plainly I see him, how much more plainly than I see Sir Percival, or Mr. Fairley, or Walter Hartwright, or any other absent person of whom I think, with the one exception of Laura herself. I can hear his voice as if he was speaking at this moment. I know what his conversation was yesterday as well as if I was hearing it now. How am I to describe him? There are peculiarities in his personal appearance, his habits and his amusements, which I should blame in the boldest terms or ridicule in the most merciless manner if I had seen them in another man. What is it that makes me unable to blame them or to ridicule them in him? For example, he is immensely fat. Before this time, I have always especially disliked corpulent humanity. I have always maintained that the popular notion of connecting excessive grossness of size and excessive good humour as inseparable allies was equivalent to declaring either that no people but amiable people ever get fat, or that the accidental addition of so many pounds of flesh has a directly favourable influence over the disposition of the person on whose body they accumulate. I have invariably combated both these absurd assertions by quoting examples of fat people who were as mean, vicious, and cruel as the leanest and the worst of their neighbours. I have asked whether Henry VIII was an amiable character, whether Pope Alexander VI was a good man, whether Mr. Murderer and Mrs. Murderess Manning were not both unusually stout people, whether hired nurses, proverbially as cruel a set of women as are to be found in all England, were not for the most part also as fat a set of women as are to be found in all England, and so on, through dozens of other examples, modern and ancient, native and foreign, high and low. Holding these strong opinions on the subject with might and main, as I do at this moment, here, nevertheless, is Count Fosco, as fat as Henry VIII himself, established in my favour at one day's notice, without let or hindrance from his own odious corpulence. Marvellous indeed. Is it his face that has recommended him? It may be his face. He is a most remarkable likeness, on a large scale, of the great Napoleon. His features have Napoleon's magnificent regularity. His expression recalls the grandly calm, immovable power of the great soldier's face. This striking resemblance certainly impressed me to begin with. But there is something in him besides the resemblance which has impressed me more. I think the influence I am now trying to find is in his eyes. They are the most unfathomable grey eyes I ever saw, and they have at times a cold, clear, beautiful, irresistible glitter in them which forces me to look at him, and yet causes me sensations when I do look, which I would rather not feel. Other parts of his face and head have their strange peculiarities. His complexion, for instance, has a singular sallow fairness, so much at variance with the dark brown colour of his hair, that I suspect the hair of being a wig, and his face, closely shaven all over, is smoother and freer from all marks and wrinkles than mine, though, according to Sir Percival's account of him, he is close on 60 years of age. But these are not the prominent personal characteristics which distinguish him, to my mind, from all the other men I have ever seen. The marked peculiarity which singles him out from the rank and file of humanity lies entirely, so far as I can tell at present, in the extraordinary expression and extraordinary power of his eyes. His manner and his command of our language may also have assisted him in some degree to establish himself in my good opinion. He has that quiet deference, that look of pleased, attentive interest in listening to a woman, and that secret gentleness in his voice in speaking to a woman, which, say what we may, we can none of us resist. Here, too, his unusual command of the English language necessarily helps him. I had often heard of the extraordinary aptitude which many Italians show in mastering our strong, hard northern speech. But until I saw Count Fosco, I had never supposed it possible that any foreigner could have spoken English as he speaks it. There are times when it is almost impossible to detect by his accent that he is not a countryman of our own, and as for fluency, there are very few born Englishmen who can talk with as few stoppages and repetitions as the Count. He may construct his sentences more or less in the foreign way, but I have never yet heard him use a wrong expression, or hesitate for a moment in his choice of a word. All the smallest characteristics of this strange man have something strikingly original and perplexingly contradictory in them. Fat as he is, and old as he is, his movements are astonishingly light and easy. He is as noiseless in a room as any of us women, and more than that, with all his look of unmistakable mental firmness and power, he is as nervously sensitive as the weakest of us. He starts at chance noises as inveterately as Laura herself. He winced and shuddered yesterday when Sir Percival beat one of the spaniels, so that I felt ashamed of my own want of tenderness and sensibility by comparison with the Count. The relation of this last incident reminds me of one of his most curious peculiarities, which I have not yet mentioned, his extraordinary fondness for pet animals. Some of these he has left on the continent, but he has brought with him to this house a cockatoo, two canary birds, and a whole family of white mice. He attends to all the necessities of these strange favourites himself, and he has taught the creatures to be surprisingly fond of him and familiar with him. The cockatoo, a most vicious and treacherous bird towards everyone else, absolutely seems to love him. When he lets it out of its cage, it hops onto his knee and claws its way up his great big body and rubs its topknot against his sallow double chin in the most caressing manner imaginable. He has only to set the doors of the canaries' cages open and to call them, and the pretty little cleverly trained creatures perch fearlessly on his hand, mount his fat outstretched fingers one by one when he tells them to go upstairs, and sing together as if they would burst their throats with delight when they get to the top finger. His white mice live in a little pagoda of gaily painted wirework, designed and made by himself. They are almost as tame as the canaries, and they are perpetually let out like the canaries. They crawl all over him, popping in and out of his waistcoat, and sitting in couples, white as snow, on his capacious shoulders. He seems to be even fonder of his mice than of his other pets, smiles at them and kisses them and calls them by all sorts of endearing names. If it be possible to suppose an Englishman with any taste for such childish interests and amusements as these, that Englishman would certainly feel rather ashamed of them, and would be anxious to apologize for them in the company of grown-up people. But the Count, apparently, sees nothing ridiculous in the amazing contrast between his colossal self and his frail little pets. He would blandly kiss his white mice and twitter to his canary birds amid an assembly of English fox-hunters, and would only pity them as barbarians when they were all laughing their loudest at him. It seems hardly credible while I am writing it down, but it is certainly true that this same man, who has all the fondness of an old maid for his cockatoo, and all the small dexterities of an organ boy in managing his white mice, can talk, when anything happens to rouse him, with a daring independence of thought, a knowledge of books in every language, and an experience of society in half the capitals of Europe, which would make him the prominent personage of any assembly in the civilized world. This trainer of canary birds, this architect of a pagoda for white mice, is, as Sir Percival himself has told me, one of the first experimental chemists living, and has discovered, among other wonderful inventions, a means of petrifying the body after death, so as to preserve it as hard as marble to the end of time. This fat, indolent, elderly man, whose nerves are so finely strung that he starts at chance noises, and winces when he sees a house spaniel get a whipping, went into the stable-yard on the morning after his arrival, and put his hand on the head of a chained bloodhound, a beast so savage that the very groom who feeds him keeps out of his reach. His wife and I were present, and I shall not forget the scene that followed, short as it was.
"Mind that dog, sir," said the groom. "He flies at everybody."
"He does that, my friend," replied the Count quietly, "because everybody is afraid of him. Let us see if he flies at me." And he laid his plump, yellow-white fingers, on which the canary birds had been perching 10 minutes before, upon the formidable brute's head, and looked him straight in the eyes.
"You big dogs are all cowards," he said, addressing the animal contemptuously, with his face and the dog's within an inch of each other. "You would kill a poor cat, you infernal coward. You would fly at a starving beggar, you infernal coward. Anything that you can surprise unawares. Anything that is afraid of your big body and your wicked white teeth and your slobbering, bloodthirsty mouth is the thing that you like to fly at. You could throttle me at this moment, you mean, miserable bully, and you daren't so much as look me in the face because I am not afraid of you. Will you think better of it and try your teeth in my fat neck? Bah, not you!" He turned away, laughing at the astonishment of the men in the yard, and the dog crept back meekly to his kennel. "Ah, my nice waistcoat," he said pathetically. "I'm sorry I came here. Some of that brute slobber has got on my pretty clean waistcoat." Those words express another of his incomprehensible oddities. He is as fond of fine clothes as the veriest fool in existence, and has appeared in 4 magnificent waistcoats already, all of light garish colours and all immensely large even for him, in the 2 days of his residence at Blackwater Park. His tact and cleverness in small things are quite as noticeable as the singular inconsistencies in his character and the childish triviality of his ordinary tastes and pursuits. I can see already that he means to live on excellent terms with all of us during the period of his sojourn in this place. He has evidently discovered that Laura secretly dislikes him. She confessed as much to me when I pressed her on the subject. But he has also found out that she is extravagantly fond of flowers. Whenever she wants a nosegay, he has got one to give her, gathered and arranged by himself, and greatly to my amusement, he is always cunningly provided with a duplicate, composed of exactly the same flowers, grouped in exactly the same way, to appease his icily jealous wife before she can so much as think herself aggrieved. His management of the Countess in public is a sight to see. He bows to her, he habitually addresses her as my angel. He carries his canaries to pay her little visits on his fingers and to sing to her. He kisses her hand when she gives him his cigarettes. He presents her with sugar plums in return, which he puts into her mouth playfully from a box in his pocket. The rod of iron with which he rules her never appears in company. It is a private rod, and is always kept upstairs. His method of recommending himself to me is entirely different. He flatters my vanity by talking to me as seriously and sensibly as if I was a man. Yes, I can find him out when I am away from him. I know he flatters my vanity when I think of him up here in my own room. And yet, when I go downstairs and get into his company again, he will blind me again, and I shall be flattered again, just as if I had never found him out at all. He can manage me as he manages his wife and Laura, as he managed the bloodhound in the stable yard, as he manages Sir Percival himself every hour in the day. My good Percival, how I like your rough English humour! My good Percival, how I enjoy your solid English sense! He puts the rudest remarks Sir Percival can make on his effeminate tastes and amusements quietly away from him in that manner, always calling the baronet by his Christian name, smiling at him with the calmest superiority, patting him on the shoulder, and bearing with him benignantly, as a good-humoured father bears with a wayward son. The interest which I really cannot help feeling in this strangely original man has led me to question Sir Percival about his past life. Sir Percival either knows little or will tell me little about it. He and the Count first met many years ago at Rome, under the dangerous circumstances to which I have alluded elsewhere. Since that time they have been perpetually together in London, in Paris, and in Vienna, but never in Italy again, the Count having, oddly enough, not crossed the frontiers of his native country for years past. Perhaps he has been made the victim of some political persecution. At all events, he seems to be patriotically anxious not to lose sight of any of his own countrymen who may happen to be in England. On the evening of his arrival, he asked how far we were from the nearest town, and whether we knew of any Italian gentleman who might happen to be settled there. He is certainly in correspondence with people on the continent, for his letters have all sorts of odd stamps on them, and I saw one for him this morning, waiting in his place at the breakfast table, with a huge official-looking seal on it. Perhaps he is in correspondence with his government, and yet that is hardly to be reconciled either with my other idea that he may be a political exile. How much I seem to have written about Count Fosco! And what does it all amount to? As poor dear Mr. Gilmore would ask in his impenetrable business-like way, I can only repeat that I do assuredly feel, even on this short acquaintance, a strange, half-willing, half-unwilling liking for the Count. He seems to have established over me the same sort of ascendancy which he has evidently gained over Sir Percival. Free, and even rude, as he may occasionally be in his manner towards his fat friend, Sir Percival is nevertheless afraid, as I can plainly see, of giving any serious offence to the Count. I wonder whether I am afraid, too. I certainly never saw a man in all my experience whom I should be so sorry to have for an enemy. Is this because I like him, or because I am afraid of him? Quizá, as Count Fosco might say in his own language, who knows? June 16th. Something to chronicle today besides my own ideas and impressions. A visitor has arrived, quite unknown to Laura and to me, and apparently quite unexpected by Sir Percival. We were all at lunch in the room with the new French windows that open into the veranda, and the Count, who devours pastry as I have never yet seen it devoured by any human beings but girls at boarding schools, had just amused us by asking gravely for his fourth tart, when the servant entered to announce the visitor. "Mr. Merriman has just come, Sir Percival, and wishes to see you immediately." Sir Percival started and looked at the man with an expression of angry alarm. "Mr. Merriman!" he repeated, as if he thought his own ears must have deceived him. "Yes, Sir Percival, Mr. Merriman from London. Where is he?" "In the library, Sir Percival." He left the table the instant the last answer was given, and hurried out of the room without saying a word to any of us. "Who is Mr. Merriman?" asked Laura, appealing to me. "I have not the least idea," was all I could say in reply. The Count had finished his fourth tart, and had gone to a side table to look after his vicious cockatoo. He turned round to us with the bird perched on his shoulder. "Mr. Merriman is Sir Percival's solicitor," he said quietly. Sir Percival's solicitor. It was a perfectly straightforward answer to Laura's question, and yet, under the circumstances, it was not satisfactory. If Mr. Merriman had been specially sent for by his client, there would have been nothing very wonderful in his leaving town to obey the summons. But when a lawyer travels from London to Hampshire without being sent for, and when his arrival at a gentleman's house seriously startles the gentleman himself, it may be safely taken for granted that the legal visitor is the bearer of some very important and very unexpected news. News which may be either very good or very bad, but which cannot, in either case, be of the common everyday kind. Laura and I sat silent at the table for a quarter of an hour or more, wondering uneasily what had happened, and waiting for the chance of Sir Percival's speedy return. There were no signs of his return, and we rose to leave the room. The Count, attentive as usual, advanced from the corner in which he had been feeding his cockatoo, with the bird still perched on his shoulder, and opened the door for us. Laura and Madame Fosco went out first. Just as I was on the point of following them, he made a sign with his hand, and spoke to me, before I passed him, in the oddest manner. "Yes," he said, quietly answering the unexpressed idea at that moment in my mind, as if I had plainly confided it to him in so many words. "Yes, Miss Halcombe, something has happened." I was on the point of answering, "I never said so," but the vicious cockatoo ruffled his clipped wings and gave a screech that set all my nerves on edge in an instant, and made me only too glad to get out of the room. I joined Laura at the foot of the stairs. The thought in her mind was the same as the thought in mine, which Count Fosco had surprised, and when she spoke, her words were almost the echo of his. She, too, said to me secretly that she was afraid something had happened.
And tantalizingly, that's where we'll leave it for this week. I know it's mean of me, but it's already gone on forever, so I am going to have to just record the next episode to ready it for your willing ears. I love this chapter. Isn't Count Fosco fabulous? I mean, Wilkie Collins really has outdone himself with fabulous characters, and Fosco is one of the best. But don't forget to pay close attention to his wife. If you remember the descriptions of her as a young girl, or at least a younger woman, and how forward and kind of out of control she was, and then you watch her now, you're going to be creeped out. And I'll leave you with that. Have a great week. Bye.
Please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Visit Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. And Knit Circus online magazine, offering 3 rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can check out the latest issue at www.knitcircus.com. And What Would Madame Defarge Knit? A new book of knit and crochet patterns coming to you from the Craftlit family. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craftlit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found at craftlit.com. Craftlit can also be accessed by its own Android and iPhone application. You can purchase it at the iPhone or iTouch application store, or you can subscribe free at iTunes. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.